The Local Thread. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our fifth episode of La Prensa Habla. This is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are here with Sue Cuevas and Adam Martinez, both who are local leaders in the Toledo Latino community. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, when we were talking a little bit before this show, there were times, and I'm sure you saw it, where your insight literally just froze me with the possibilities of my wheels were turning. So share that with some of the listeners. Tell us about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Adam Martinez. I was born and raised in South Toledo. I went to St. Pat's, St. John's, and then after that, I went onto the Air Force, served in the Air Force at Nellis Air Force Base for 2 years. I got out early. It was peacetime with a program called Palace Chase to go to college. Jumped around colleges because I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do when I grew up. But I finished up at Lourdes College, well, university now. And then I finished my master's work there also in organizational leadership with a focus on government and nonprofit strategy. So from there, I got involved in nonprofit development. I worked for a nonprofit that's no longer there called Viva South Toledo CDC. Excuse me, before that, it was Heritage South, which is no longer there. Then it became Viva South Toledo CDC. So I cut my teeth in the nonprofit world early on in my career. And then thereafter, I went on to get more involved in public policy because as a nonprofit director doing real estate in the Old South End, there was a lot of challenges from a public policy standpoint. And I got tired of yelling at the sky about what's wrong with government. So I decided to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So I started getting involved on, you know, local and state boards. And then I was recruited to go work for a national organization called Local Initiative Support Corporation, otherwise known as the LISC. Most people don't know what LISC is, but they are an intermediary that helps nonprofits and for-profit companies give resources to neighborhoods and community organizations. They're kind of an intermediary, if you will. And they also do a lot of the financing for nonprofit real estate development. So I worked for them for a couple years and still got really involved and engaged in public policy, but I felt I was missing something. So I finished almost all of my graduate work in urban planning with a focus around real estate development. So there, that kind of bridged a lot of the gaps in the public policy, the real estate, and the financing portion to make sure that I had a very holistic approach to help improve our communities. So that gave me a very different perspective from being, we'll say, in the trenches, you know, yelling up, and also a different perspective from the middle ground saying, why aren't people doing this? And then from the top level also, why aren't, you know, more people applying for these funds? So it was a really a great opportunity to learn holistically how real estate deals are done, especially in with nonprofits that don't may not have the real estate capacity or financial acumen to get very complex deals done. So it was a great learning opportunity, and I use that in my professional career, but also as an elected official, I'm able to help bridge some of those gaps and make sure that nonprofits have access to resources or at least understand what they're getting into when they move forward. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of some of my background and how I started in this kind of weird position as an elected official.
And a lot of your work, I'm sure, later in life, that's how you met Sue. But Sue, let's not start there. Tell us about your background and how you grew up.
Okay. Well, again, I'm Sue Cuevas, and I was born in a small little town called Wauseon, Ohio, which is northwest Ohio. Mm-hmm. But when I was 5 years old, my dad was a pastor. My mom and dad were pastors, and they moved to Youngstown. And it was more of a Puerto Rican culture. So I grew up, you know, mainly thinking I was Puerto Rican, right? Not knowing that we were technically Hispanic. So for the longest time, you know, that was our culture. You know, the food, you know, my mom would cook all Puerto Rican food. So, and then, you know, I attended Youngstown State University right there in Youngstown. And then from there, I also attended Grand Valley State University. And then I also went to a Christian college in Mexico, where my dad and some of my relatives had attended. So I felt like I needed to do the same thing, right? So in 93, I started in the financial banking industry. And I worked there until 2010, when I was asked if I could help start up a credit union.
Did someone here ask you that?
Well,
I see a side eye.
well, you know, I don't know. There was a friend of mine, Sonia Troche. She was with Adelante. Mm-hmm. And she calls me and she says, hey, you know, they're going to start a credit union. And actually several of the leaders in Toledo. I was familiar with Toledo, the South End, because at that time I was a VP for a Fifth Third Bank. And so I would come to a lot of the Hispanic events. So I was kind of familiar. And so, you know, we met and, you know, the next thing I know is, okay, well, they've selected you as a CEO. And the first thing I said was, I am not a CEO. I've never been one. I don't know how to be one, but I will help them for a year.
That's exactly what I said. I see Adam kind of like.
Yeah. Hmm. And I said, now I'm bilingual. You know, I speak Spanish. I read it. I write it. I believe I know the culture, understand the culture, but I'm only going to do this for a year because I come from banking,
yep.
Right? Well, I learned a lot about credit unions. One of the philosophies and the main thing is that it's a people helping people, mm-hmm. You know, and not just, you know, with our, you know, credit union members, but in the credit union world, right? We can branch out to them, ask them for anything. And so when I started, there was absolutely nothing. I had one desk. Directions Credit Union lent me an office. Barry Shaner is on our advisory board. Excellent. And so he lent me an office. I walk in, there's absolutely nothing in there, nothing but a phone. And so they gave me a laptop, and I tell Barry, okay, now what? He goes, oh, well, you have to start the credit union. And I'm like, what? You know, part of the Latina in me was like, are you kidding me? You know, coming from someone who had assistance coming. But I took the challenge, and I'm glad I did. Mm-hmm. So this will be my 16th year in May, and I absolutely love it. And so, of course, you know, I have an excellent board, and Adam has been on our board for a long time.
I was going to say, I bet the other Latina part in you was like, I got this.
Yeah, I did. I said, okay, I can do this.
Adam, how do you remember this happening?
So she's very modest. absolutely is correct. There was a lot of buzz around this person named Sue Cuevas, and you know, she was coming from corporate and she would do great things, and I was like, okay, great. I was on the search committee. So Viva South had kind of started the initial process. So this was already like 3-4 years in the making. We had been going into fundraising mode and board meetings, and I remember thinking, okay, we're finally here. You know, next step is to get a CEO so they can take this and run with it. And there was some good applicants, but, you know, Sue just definitely stood, you know, head above shoulders above the applicants and just had this passion for service. And that's what sold me. And so, yeah, she is very much correct. She had a borrowed office and literally started the credit union out of the back of her car.
Right. Mm.
So imagine nowadays starting something out of the back of your car with a cash box, you know, $5 here, $5 there, and grew the organization to what it is today, which is, you know, in my opinion, a top tier organization that would rival any credit union in our country. Mm. Last I heard, we were the third Latino-based credit union in the country, first in the state of Ohio, and that was 15 years ago. So we get a lot of inquiries, you know, throughout the country. You know, how did you do it? A lot of tenacity and a lot of you said I can't swear, so I'll be polite, but a lot of
ganas
and gratitude. Thank you. I was going to use a different word, but we'll go with that one. So, but no, Sue's done a phenomenal job. We just, I think, celebrated our quinceañera, right?
Yes, last year.
This past year. You know, and I've had the privilege of being board chair for 14 or 15 of those years, and I was very pleased to see how much we've grown and expanded. So it's not just Lucas County, it's what, 4 counties now?
Yes, outside.
Yeah, so, and that we're helping grow economic power in our community.
The credit union is the only one, the first and the only Latino credit union in Ohio?
Yes.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel excited. And we still are the only one in Ohio. There have been quite a few leaders, like in Columbus and Cincinnati, even in Cleveland, that they would like to start a Latino credit union. And our Ohio Credit Union League, based out of Columbus, always, you know, always refers them to us. Mm-hmm. But there's already run, don't reinvent the wheel, just ask Sue. Mm-hmm. But it's been exciting, right? It's been exciting to start with no members except the board, mm-hmm. you know, absolutely no loans. We are over $3 million in loans mm-hmm. From our community. And we have joint accounts of about 1,600.
I think I was one of the first, you know, members. I have borrowed from the bank, the credit union, mm-hmm. a few times. It's such an easy process. This startup, though, it's also reminding me, Adam, I feel like you have started some other initiatives in the South End. Can you talk about those?
So one of the programs is the Toledo Micro Enterprise Development Initiative that helps with nonprofits. That was an agreement with the Port Authority that would help nonprofits that are doing real estate development to help with funding. So I worked with the chairman, one of the members, Margarita De Leon, and then Thomas Winston, who was the chairman at the time, to help establish that program in support of the levy program that happens every year. And then also, it used to be called the MCAP program, but now it's called the Diversity Contractor Acceleration Program that helps fund small contractors. One of the challenges we have in our communities isn't the skill set or the ability to do the work. It's having the cash flow to be able to bid on bigger jobs and get bonded appropriately. So this program was a coalition project within the African American community, the Latino community, and the Port Authority to help support small business enterprises grow and expand. And then there also was another program that was actually based out of Columbus. They had a program in Cleveland. We didn't have one in Detroit, and that was a micro-enterprise program that helps small business lending, that helps with business planning, strategic planning for small businesses to be able to apply for bigger loans. So I was always been a big advocate of supporting minority and women-owned businesses and throughout my professional career, and having a bully pulpit, so to speak, when you're an elected official, you're able to weigh in on some of these very important issues to our community and also give some support and make sure funding goes to where it needs to go to. So those were some of the projects I've been working on early on, and as we move forward, you know, I still continue to be involved with economic development initiatives at the city level, working with the administration. Wade Capps-Cavage, his staff is awesome to work with. And then even in my professional career, part of what I do is real estate development up in Detroit, Michigan. We also have a program, while I didn't start it, I certainly support it. They have a program to help underrepresented developers and the African-American community and Latino community to help be a part of the rebuilding and branding of Detroit, Michigan. So that's specifically the bricks and sticks and how do we get more affordable units into our neighborhoods. So with the Ebiera Fund, they actually help support and fund not only the project, but they also fund the actual business enterprise. Because when you're in real estate development, nobody really thinks about, can you eat? Or, you know, are you maxing out your credit cards to get this project done? And then you take everything back when you do take out financing, or hopefully the cash flow helps pay off your credit cards and your light bill and your staff. So that is also a challenge, not just in the construction industry, but also in the real estate development industry. And we have very few resources to help our emerging, what I would call nascent or emerging developers or even contractors grow and expand. So that's kind of really where my professional focus has been to date.
So a lot of your contributions are through urban planning, economic development through that lens, and you're super sophisticated about it, and I imagine that you think it's really important for generational wealth in a community. Can you break that down? Like, why is it important? Break it down to somebody who has no knowledge about this.
Wow, that's a good question. So a part of this is really about your economic power is tied to your political power. And what I mean by that is if you understand how the rules are played, you can compete like anybody else. So if you understand how business works, if you understand how your economic power, whether it's your spending power, whether your ability to invest or do something or start something, your creative entrepreneurship can lead to other things that would put you in rooms where you normally wouldn't have the opportunity to be. Part of it is relationship building, because everybody wants to be a part of someone that's successful. And then secondly, once you start surrounding yourself with people who are invested in your success as much as you are, then you start to build political power. And that's, I can get a little bit more in detail on that later.
Yes, definitely, because we do have to wrap up here, our first segment. So we'll be back here in after the short break. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our second segment of La Prensa Habla. This is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are still here with Adam Martinez and Sue Cuevas. I have a two-part question for you. So, Adam, I'll start with you. You just mentioned that a lot of the work is relationship building. And so we have a diverse community that has diverse opinions and thoughts. So if the Latino community or those supporting it want to make change amidst those diverse thoughts, what is your advice? And then after you answer that, I know that Nueva Esperanza is doing this and has done this. So then I want to hear the real life example from Nueva Esperanza.
So I think a lot of it is conversation and, you know, again, relationship building. I think, as you pointed out, our community is very, very diverse, whether it's economically, politically, we span the gambit. So there is no cookie cutter Latino, so to speak. And then when we're thinking about how do we engage our community, it isn't just one set way. It's maybe a formal meeting with one group of people. Maybe it's a coffee and a bread with another set. But the reality is Toledo is a very small community. In Northwest Ohio in general is a small community. And we all have this common goal. It's just how do we get there? And the more communication we have, I would highly recommend you don't come in with one perceived or set of way of doing things and be flexible, because what may work for one part of our community may not work for the other. There are some presumptions that are often made. Not everybody speaks Spanish. You know, I'm a no sabo baby myself, you know, but my family's been here since the 1900s. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't socially acceptable to speak another language back then. And my great grandfather made sure that all of his children spoke English and didn't speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was also an asset because my great grandparents could speak Spanish and they were a help on the railroads. My family came with railroads. Some families come through other migratory means. Maybe it's through the fields. Maybe it's through manufacturing plants. It just really depends. So I don't think there is one unified origin story of our community, and it's very diverse. And I think people need to respect that. And I think our approach is always more is welcome. But at some point, a decision does have to be made, because then you can get into analysis paralysis where nothing gets done because there's so many diverging opinions. But at some point, you have to make a decision. And not everyone's going to be happy. Not everyone's going to be mad. And so you end up someplace in the middle.
Mm-hmm. And Sue, I know that you do advocacy for Nueva Esperanza. You've worked so hard to maintain that relational type banking. So talk to us about what advocacy you do at the local level, the state, and even the national level.
Okay. Small credit unions are very few, but they are very well needed, especially, for example, we are at 1638 Broadway. We're in the lower level of the Compassion Health Clinic. Mm-hmm. And we serve everyone in the community. You know, we're a community credit union, so we serve anyone in Lucas County, and we serve other counties. Actually, if they work, if they live, if they volunteer, if they attend church, they qualify to be, you know, a credit union member. So basically in the local level, you know, it's probably the most important thing is financial literacy. I mean, they come, you know, over here from different countries, and they don't know anything. Their goal is to just make it. It's like an American dream, right? Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that there's credit that needs to be established. They don't realize that, okay, you know, I may go somewhere where they don't speak my language, and I can try to make myself understand, but I sometimes are mocked, you know, because I don't speak it well. I didn't, you know. And so we really strive when they come in, even to open, you know, an account, a savings account, we go through almost a 30-minute segment of what is a credit union, how it's going to help you, what we can do for you. And we go through the whole process in the same way if they come in to establish credit, right? So we do a lot of financial education. I teach financial education mostly on a quarterly basis in Bowling Green. I've done a lot of it here, you know, in Toledo.
But you have these conversations with legislators as well,
right?
So talk to us about that. How do you have those conversations to maintain the integrity of your credit union?
Okay. You know, sometimes as a Latina, you don't feel like you deserve to be up by the podium with the legislators, right? You feel like intimidated, or you feel like, oh, why me? But I have learned in the past 15 years that we have a voice and we have a story. Mm-hmm. We've helped a lot of people establish local, you know, food truck businesses, you know, landscaping businesses, you know, car maintenance businesses, you know, a lot of small businesses that we've helped. And so our story at Capitol Hill is to say, this is the reason why small credit unions need to still stay impacted individually and not be forced to merge with a larger credit union. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, you know, we feel, well, we don't have all the services applicable to our members. But you have to understand that we serve a special community, right? For example, some don't know how to read or write in English. So they're telling me, well, I don't even need a debit card or a checking account because, you know, I mean, it's trust that brings them to us. And even then, you know, the Latino community has a lot of trust issues, right? And for sure, because they've been abused in their countries. So when we go to Washington and stand there and we share, I've always been asked to represent the Latino small credit unions. Mm-hmm. And I feel very honored to do that. But we share stories of what we're doing, how we've made a difference in their lives, how it's, you know, how regulatory issues shouldn't be so strong on small credit unions, right? Don't compare me with a billion-dollar credit union to a 4.5 million, right? We talk about, you know, regulatory issues, you know, as far as like if we work with people that have an ITIN number, right? So all of those things make a difference when you stand in front of them and you share your story and you say, I am from Nueva Esperanza, you know, in Toledo, Ohio, and this is what we have. So I usually go with, you know, the amount of loans that we did, you know, who did we help? I share stories. And Marcy Kaptur has been a very strong supporter. So even when we're meeting with her, it's nice to be recognized by a first name basis, right? Mm-hmm. That means that she knows what we do. So that's the reason we've done it locally at Columbus, you know, at a lot of events, a lot of recognition nationally speaking. Mm-hmm. So we're proud. You know, even if you're small, you can do big things. Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started my business, and even to this day, I tell my team, we're a Latino owned business. And I always tell my team, you know, we have to give 150% because, you know, you could have somebody that isn't a Latino-owned business, and they could give, you know, 80%. And it would equal to the same amount that we're, you know, even if we give 100%, 150%, and they give 80%, some people will just choose to go with a non-Latino business. And thankfully, you know, I had some financial literacy as well. And you know, but how do we, I guess, as like Latino business owners and just the Latino community in general, how can... Why do you think we have that mindset or that thought process, and how do we just help each other as business owners and as a community unite so that we can feel like we don't have to give 150%, 200%, knowing that that's going to be just above ground zero, I guess, if that makes sense.
And I truly understand that. You know, one of the things that as entrepreneurs or even small businesses. You know, I've always said that Nueva Esperanza is a fountain, you know, for financial support. We can work, you know, with them, and we can just help each other out and, you know, put your name in kind of a pot where everybody, you know, has access to references and businesses where they can count on. But one of the things that I would have to say is that as our mindset has to be changed, you know, we're the ones that hold ourselves back, right? It's not because they are better, because we all have the same brain cells, right? Mm-hmm. We all have the same brain. We all have the same capabilities. And so we sometimes hold ourselves back because I'm Hispanic or I'm Latino, or they didn't give me this because I am Hispanic, I am Latino, mm-hmm. or they didn't let me play, you know, in the basketball team as a starter because I am Latino, I am. So sometimes we have to just force ourselves to be out there and say, I am just as good as anybody else. And mm-hmm. so, yes, even though you give 150% and they give 80, but you're giving, you know, the best that you can. Mm-hmm. And pretty much that's what everybody probably, you know, expects. Mm-hmm. So I say, don't hold back.
I mean, yeah, I love that. It's like you're talking about not playing small anymore. Right. And, you know, in research, I saw that according to the Census Bureau, by 2060, the year 2060, Latinos will add over 20 million people to the working age population, whereas non-Latinos will be subtracting 12 million. Can you imagine with those numbers if we just stop playing small?
Where do you find those resources? Because this is from my own personal experience. You know, when I started, and some people think Salinas isn't like a Hispanic name. I've heard that before, which I was like, how do you, you know? But, I kind of, in a way, I was like, you know, okay, so I'm starting a Latino-owned business, Salinas. I thought people would reach out to me, Hispanic leaders, right? Say, hey. You know, here are some resources. Mm-hmm. Here's what we can do. Here's how we can help each other. Here's how we can help you grow as a business, right? But that didn't happen. How can we, as a community, make sure that that happens to other business owners that go out there and say, hey, I want to start my own business?
Coming from the credit union side of it, you know, we are able to help. Now, we are not, at this moment, specializing in commercial lending, but we do have some programs that will help. You know, some programs. But I really feel that the relationship that you have with a credit union or with your bank, you know, we promote the membership, right? They have, somebody asks for a, they want somebody, okay, here's Salinas Exteriors, right? But we're familiar with that. I don't know that without you promoting it yourself and you saying, hey, Sue, can I leave my business card? Absolutely, you know, or can I put this special flyer I have? Mm. You know, okay, so we can do that. But I think a lot of it is we just can't wait for them to come to us, mm-hmm. right? Unfortunately, as Latinos, we have to aggressively be out there and do more than anybody else. Why? Because the mindset of a lot of people is that we're not specializing, you know, in certain mm-hmm. things, and maybe we're not good enough, right? So we have to. I mean, even with the credit union, you know, some people still believe that, you know, well, it's not going to continue. That it would, they thought we were going to, you know, have to merge with someone after the second year, mm-mm. you know, and it was because it takes time to build your business, right? But I think, you know, persistence makes it. I mean, you're just going to have to work to promote that. You mm-hmm. know, there's a lot of organizations that we join to promote the credit union. We attend a lot of events so that way they know who Sue is, you know. And sometimes, you know, some people don't want to do that. You know, they don't want to go out in the community. Mm-hmm. In the very beginning, and Adam can vouch for this, I was working 7 days. Mm-hmm. Every Latino festival, every church event, I was at every prayer group. You know, mm-hmm. and that's because we needed to promote. I couldn't wait for them to come just because they heard the name.
Just because it was a Latino credit union.
Right.
We can't assume that everyone who's Latino is going to flock
absolutely.
To you. I'm hearing themes of persistence. I heard a little bit of aggression. And that reminds me, Adam, when you were younger, you marched alongside your uncle. That was your first witness of advocacy. How is it that you've stayed engaged for that long and have it become cynical?
Good question. Yeah. So my first experience in community organizing was with my uncle Roberto Gonzalez, and I remember marching with the Brown Berets on, I think, with Broadway maybe. But I also remember like the Maya Center, the Guadalupe Center, all of these great organizations that are no longer that a lot of people continue to fight. And advocacy for, regardless if it was health, social issues, or economic issues, the fight hasn't ended. It's just maybe morphed into something a little bit different. Maybe instead of a blatant, back then, racial policy, it become more of a bureaucratic policy, right? So there's same but different. I think, you know, without becoming cynical, and I will admit I've become cynical and a little bit jaded just because you can only yell at the sky for so long before your voice starts to go hoarse.
You could keep going if you wanted to.
Yeah. It's a matter of being able to, number one, pass on the torch and make sure that the next generation understands the importance of everything that we have built and can maintain. So the credit union, again, has been at least almost 20 years in the making. And hopefully the next generation of the board, and as Sue, you know, eventually, although she's not allowed to, does eventually want to retire at some point, you know, can carry on that torch about financial literacy and helping grow and expand on the small business resources in our community. But also on the public side, making sure that we still continue to have advocates for our community, for social service programs, for healthcare programs, for education programs. Right now on Toledo City Council, we have the most Latino representation we've ever had in our history, and that's two. So that's Councilwoman Morris, Teresa Morris. She is a District 6 representative, and myself. We have one representative on Toledo School Board, and then one member Toledo Lucas County. That's all the representation we have. We have no representation at the state level, and limited representation at the federal level. Let me back up. So we do have some Latino representation in the state level, just not Northwest Ohio. So I want to make sure I'm clear about that. But, you know, you have to keep on the banner and fight until it becomes, you know, we get the justice that we demand and deserve. You know, we are taxpayers. We live in this community. We deserve the same thing like everybody else. And I guess if I can just kind of touch on your question about, you know, why didn't more people reach out to a Latino-owned business. And it's not that people don't want to. They maybe just didn't know, right? So I know I get that a lot as an elected official. Well, I opened a business in your community or in your district. How come you didn't come visit? Well, I didn't know. If I knew, I absolutely will show up. And then the cynical part of me as a small business owner who kind of came with those same kind of struggles, a lot of times I just felt like people don't care. Right. And I get this from other like black owned businesses, owners that I know. And they're just like, they just don't care. It's not that they don't care. They just don't know. But then even if they do help support you, you want to make sure you're surrounding yourself with people who are in the same mindset that aren't going to bring you down because you're a Latino owned business or a black owned business, that they're going to help support you and prop you up and promote you. Because a lot of times we tend to tear ourselves down. Right. It's kind of self-deprecating at times.
And kind of like Jessica said, you know, it's really, you know, it's all, or I think it was Sue that said it. It's all about mindset, you know, because it's. I see both sides of the coin, I guess. You know, I have a lot of just white American business owners that I see how they support each other. I see how they help each other, and on the other end, you know, I see the Hispanic business owners that are up and coming and whatnot, and I try to support them and try to help them, and you know, but you know, I don't care about the support, getting that support back, but there's just the disconnect, like some type of division that, yeah, you know, like you said, we have to change that mindset about each other.
We have power in numbers, and we have power in our diversity, and we as a people really need to stop using the diversity as reasons to be divided, because what other great strategy political strategy than division, right? And we have the numbers. I mean, the 2060, we're adding 20 million while others are subtracting 12 million. We really need to stop holding ourselves back.
And that is it for our second segment. You know, we'll be back for our third, and once again, my favorite segment, the food segment. So
we're having pasteles, which is the word of the day. Has various different meanings and is so delicious.
Yeah, pasteles, to me, it translates as cake. From what I just learned today, pasteles is also like tamales for Puerto Ricans.
Puerto Rican-like tamales.
Welcome back, everyone, to our third segment. This is Kevin Salinas.
And I am Jessica Molina. We are back with Sue Cuevas, but we also have Alicia Bowes here. And some of you may know her as a pastor at Compassion in Calvary, but we're learning today that she's also an amazing cook. So tell us what you brought today.
Today I brought Puerto Rican pasteles en hoja.
So tell us. With pork. Okay, so how did you make it? Because this looks amazing.
Like anything that tastes really good, it takes a long time to make and a lot of heart has to go into it. So first you start by preparing the roots, which are plantain, pumpkin, malanga, and yautía. And then you have to peel them, blend them up. And then the pork, I use like pork butt, you use pork shoulder. You've got to cook that with some amazing spices and allow that to cook down and, you know, get soft. And then you use that broth that comes from the pork, and you add that to the base, which is like a masa, but it's made from roots. So it's very similar to, not very similar, but similar to Mexican tamales, but made with plantains as the base.
That's what I was going to say. It really looks like a Honduran nacatamal, right?
Yeah.
Which
I've shared with Kevin's family, which are amazing.
And it's wrapped in,
it's a banana leaf.
Banana leaf, yes. That's the word.
Instead of the corn husk.
Yeah, and I tried it, and you can definitely taste like the malanga. Everything you just said, you can like definitely taste. It's crazy how...
I feel like they're a little more filling than a Mexican tamale, too. So, because of all of those roots, I mean, if you can't eat a whole bunch of plantains, that's what
it's
is in
so
there.
So nutritious.
Yeah.
So nutrient dense.
And so...
Definitely a lot of calories.
Sue, you grew up with kind of a Puerto Rican influence. So tell us about, did you eat these as a child? What did that look like for you as a kid?
Well, first of all, thank you, Alicia, because these are my favorite. And just looking at them like, oh, wow, this is really good. But yes, when I was 5 years old, my parents moved to Youngstown. In Youngstown, there's so many Puerto Ricans, Italians. So funny thing is, we thought we were Puerto Rican, as you know, my siblings. We really thought we were Puerto Rican. My mom grew up making all Puerto Rican food. So she didn't make Mexican rice. She didn't really make enchiladas. You know, it was all Puerto Rican food. So really, we thought we were until about 8 years old. I came home from school and I was so excited because I said, I have a new friend in school and she's Mexican. And my mom said, well, so are you. I literally cried. Because I thought, no, I don't want to be Mexican. I want to be Puerto Rican. So,
but you just didn't know. You didn't know any different.
No, I didn't know.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't. And that's a nice thing about Latinos, right? We blend in so well where we don't see differences in a lot of things. But pasteles are my favorite. They really, really are. And I hadn't had one all year because I didn't know where to go get them. But now, Alicia Bowes.
Now you know.
Now I know. Yes.
And Alicia, you make recipes for La Prensa every single week, right? Has this one been on it yet or no?
It has not yet. Something I'm really trying to work on in this new year is really measuring things because, you know, especially in Latino houses, you know, everybody measures with their heart. Nobody has a real set recipe. Mm-hmm. But that's something I'm working on measuring. So I am working to put those in this year. It'll be a long recipe for the paper. But yes, please look into the recipes. Every week there's a new one. So no repeats.
I read that these are like a community food. That typically there may, because so much goes into it, that it's like a family affair. So did either of you experience that in your own upbringing, like moments where you were all together as a family making this?
I did not. But when I make them now, because I learned how to make these, because this is one of my husband's favorite dishes. So I'm Mexican, and I'd never heard of pasteles. And we went to a Puerto Rican restaurant, I believe it was in Cleveland, and tasted them, and I loved them. So I had to learn how to make them, because that's who I am. Mm-hmm. And anytime I make them now, I get everybody involved, because it is a lot of work. And yeah, more hands makes the load lighter, so I'm like, you peel this, you cut this, you chop this, you clean this, you do all of that. And then when you're putting them together, it does make it go a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So,
how much time does it take altogether? Let's say with help and without help.
So this last time I probably made about 24, and I started the night before, and it probably took me 2 or 3 hours just to prepare the masa and cook down the pork. And then the next day, it probably took me an hour, hour and a half to wrap them all up.
Wow.
Can you make them out of chicken?
Yes, can do different fillings. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people do vegan options, too, like with chickpeas and stuff. So.
Yes. Hmm. You're speaking to my heart now.
Well, my mom and dad did make them when we were growing up. So I never really helped a lot, because it is a lot of work.
It is.
But they love to do it. As a matter of fact, my dad, even though he's 90, he'll be 91, and he's been ill. But for Christmas last year, he did make a few, but just a dozen, mm-hmm, you know, because of his health. Mm-hmm. But yes, we made him every year.
Brings back those childhood memories.
It does. It really does.
It's also known to be a holiday food. So
it's made a lot around Christmas time. Because, mm-hmm, you know, you're unwrapping. It's like unwrapping a gift.
That's right.
And it just feels like family. And I think that's what recipes and home cooking really is. Mm-hmm. Just to feel, you know, that sense of childhood or family. All those tastes come back, and that's what you think of.
Mm-hmm. This isn't something that you enjoy frequently, because it takes too much time to put together. You can't just make it every week.
And I'm eating it slow so I can savor every minute. And who knows when I'll have another one, right? So it's delicious, Alisa. Absolutely.
It is very
delicious.
Good. It is very, yes, very good.
So we can expect to see this in La Prensa newspaper as,
yes,
a recipe.
Very soon.
She's like, stop pressuring me.
I just got to get the measurements together.
I can imagine that would break your flow, you know?
It does.
Because if you're not measuring, you're just this and that and a little bit of this.
Well, I had put my rice recipe into La Prensa, which it really is a fusion of Mexican and Puerto Rican, because I don't use tomato sauce like most Mexican households do in their rice. I use sazon, mm-hmm, which is Puerto Rican. They use spice. It's a Puerto Rican spice that they use for a lot of things. And so my rice, I was like, oh my gosh, let me see how much onion powder I use, how much chicken bouillon I use. Because you don't. You just measure with your heart and check for taste.
Mm-hmm.
Do pasteles have like rice inside of them or anything or no?
No, not. Mm-hmm. So I'm not Puerto Rican, so I don't really know all of the things. But what I have seen is I haven't seen rice inside of them. But the nacatamales do.
Right, like, exactly. Yeah, because it really reminds me of nacatamales, because
and nacatamales are like a fusion of pasteles and like Mexican tamal. It's
Yeah, because they're also only made, we only make nacatamales like during like holiday season and stuff, you know. So same thing as tamales and, you know, so it's all very similar, you know, and I think how as a community, right, we all kind of share the same ideas, but it just differs per country. So I think it's very neat of us as Latinos.
Even the word pasteles, right, it has so many different meanings. It means pastries, right? So when Linda said that you had pasteles, I was expecting like pan dulce or something. But it's more of a tamale.
Yeah.
But I fear that saying that is actually offensive. It is not a Mexican tamale.
No, it's not. It's similar in the wrapping and, you know, really like it's something stuffed with meat or whatever filling, but very different flavor profiles.
Very different flavor.
So as you eat this pastel, what does it remind you of?
Oh, it reminds me of my mom. And growing up, and how every holiday season we would get together and make some, or family traditional, you know, like Puerto Rican families would bring them to our house. I mean, you always expected to eat these at Christmas. So, you know, it's definitely one of my favorite, but I have never made them. I might never make them with all
I
the work that
invite
it has
you
to.
Over
she might
to
have
make.
To invite me to help her, and I will.
Alicia will put you to work.
Yes,
listen,
will.
I will put anybody to work in a hurry.
I would work for these, okay? I would work for those. But it does bring back good memories, right? It kind of nostalgic in the sense of like, wow, you know, this is home, right?
So if you heard the words, "Hay pasteles," what would you do?
I would prefer, I would say which kind. Because, somebody will say, I'm going to take, you know, a pastel to you. Well, for example, they'll say, I'm going to give you, or I'm going to stop by and drop off a pastel, right? Well, I'm hoping it's this Puerto Rican pastel, but they do show up with like, you know, tres leche cake or, you know, any pastry and everything. But yes, this is very heartwarming to me. It just brings back a lot of, you know, good memories of my mom.
So I've learned also that every family really thinks that they have the best recipe, that they have the best pasteles. So, Sue, how do these pasteles compare to your family's?
Well, these have really good flavor. Not that my mom's didn't. My mom's were a little darker, and I don't know if it's some of the spices she put in it.
It could have been the achiote oil.
Achiote, right. So, so they're still flavorful. I will never complain really about a pastel because everybody makes them a little different,
that's
right?
True.
And so it's like you can't compare, you know, a tres leches cake like with what everybody makes because they all make them a little different. But these are really, really good. I mean, they're really, really good. And
I saw your face after your first bite.
I know. I'm just like, yay, I'm glad I didn't have breakfast this morning. this is breakfast of champions. But I would say that, you know, I think everybody makes them according to what, you know, I mean, my mom had to learn, you know, she didn't know. The first ones were like, oh, I forgot to put salt. Oh, yes, we can tell. But, you know, as time went on, you know, she learned from other women. But I think these are absolutely delicious.
That's a lot how I have learned cooking, too, because it's really when you grow up and just learn, you blend in. With, you know, different people. So I've learned a lot of tips and tricks from church mothers.
Right.
So for so during the holidays, which ones do you make? Do you make pasteles? Do you make tamales, Alicia, or what do you make?
So 1 year we tried to make tamales for Christmas and it was an epic fail. And then that next year we just bought some. So there's a lady in our church, her name is Maria Elena, and she makes some of the best tamales. And we just told her to make them, and we boiled them or steamed them ourselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that, too, we were like 2 hours later, why aren't they done? But you have to let them sit for a while. So
that's the hardest
part. That was, yeah. So these I make more.
So you make more pasteles than you
do. Yeah, I gave that a rest because it wasn't good. There's so much, it's just like that masa needs so much flavor. I don't know. We didn't do it right. I guess I'll have to retry that again.
And Sue, growing up, do you guys eat it like breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Or is it just is it more of a dinner or a lunch meal?
It's anytime. No. growing up, you know, my mom would make them only like during the holidays. That's traditionally, you know, what they would make. And we would have those around the holidays throughout the year. Because it is a lot of work. You know, she rarely did make them, but it was a really special treat for us at Christmas. We knew we were going to have pasteles, and you pair it with white rice, you know, and what's called tostones, right, which is fried
plantain
right? So that was the specialty. But it wasn't like an everyday thing. And then once she made them, you know, that's all we wanted. Right? Okay, dinner, let's have that white rice. Lunch, well, I'll just have one of those, you know.
It's like a delicacy.
Yes.
So along with the amount of time that it takes to perfect the recipe, I know sometimes people guard it, right? Like my family has perfected this and it's taken us this many years with so many people giving you the knowledge and making it better. Do you feel guarded with your recipe at all? Will it be an issue for you to put it in La Prensa?
No, there's a lot of recipes that I've shared just because I know a lot of times that people fail to pass down recipes in generations. Mm-hmm. They never write them down. So mm-hmm. they're always like fighting to get that, you know, oh, I just want to taste grandma's rice, or I just want to taste mom's this. So I think that's another reason why I really wanted to put recipes into La Prensa so that when my girls are older, they won't have to guess what I put in my food. They'll know exactly what I did, how much I put, and they'll never have to chase that taste. They'll know this was mom's recipe.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't talk at all about the banana leaf, but there has to be some sort of technique in preparing that as well. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, the banana leaves, I'd buy them from the store and then I just clean them thoroughly. So that just adds an extra sense of flavor to it. It's very earthy.
You say that, like, does it affect the taste in a bad way?
No, I like the taste, but everyone doesn't. So when they taste them, they're like, oh, these are earthy, but it's the banana leaf. I like it because I like it.
I prefer the banana leaf, but my mom would also wrap them in foil.
Yeah.
And then cook them. And, you know, they were kind of cooked and steamed in the foil. Yeah. So, and you have to learn how to wrap those up really good. Yeah, there's a technique for wrapping those in foil, too.
I can imagine.
Lots of technique.
Mm-hmm. Technique and steaming them, too, I'm sure.
We actually wrap them in both. First the banana leaf and then the foil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I don't know why, but.
I did banana leaf and then parchment paper, and then I put two together and I tie them up. Mm-hmm. That'll all be in the recipe. That's what I'm saying. It's going to be a long recipe. I need to do like a video of it or something.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it takes how many hours altogether?
Well, the last time it probably really took me about 4.5 hours, like, to prepare them completely together. So,
wow.
Well, we do have to wrap up, so I want to thank our listeners first and foremost. Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Alicia. And thank you, Adam.
We were so fortunate to have Adam here. There have been times that I've talked to him, and he literally, his insight stops me in my tracks. So I'm so glad that we had a mic in front of him today. And just thank you all for listening. And we look forward to releasing this episode in the next.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.